Twill starts now with Venkat Balasubramani, Jonathan Bailey, and Evan Brown. We're going to talk about Twitter as the head of the Social Media Justice League, likejacking, Snapchatting, HBO cluelessness, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 161, recorded May 11, 2012. Impunity always rides shotgun. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile. By Citrix. Try ShareFile today. I have a great offer to get you started, a 30-day free trial plus double storage. To get this offer, visit ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter my promo code TWILL. Hello, I'm Denise Howell. This is This Week in Law, and we've got a fantastic panel with us today. I'm so excited to chat with these guys. Coming back on the show is Venkat Balasubramani from Focal Law, and of course, Eric Goldman's technology and marketing blog, where he blogs very frequently and very well. Hi, Venkat. Nice to see you.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Jonathan. Hi, Evan. I'm excited to be on the show, as always.
Great to have you back. Also joining us again is Jonathan Bailey from Plagiarism Today. Hello, Jonathan.
Hey, Denise, thanks for having me back. I'm very glad to be here and very glad my loud neighbors stopped just in time.
Yes, I'm glad too. If they start using colorful language, just, you know, turn up the volume and we'll enjoy it along with you.
Sounds good.
Okay, and also coming to us from Chicago, Illinois, Hinshaw and Culbertson, and his blog, internetcases.com, is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. It's good to be here. I'm also very happy to be here. So nice to see you, and looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. You too. I am really excited to talk about lots and lots of stuff we have been batting around this week in advance of the show. Why don't we start out on the copyright front and talk about Perfect 10, which it's not a big mystery that this was going to happen, but they have finally come along and sued Tumblr. They seem to sue everybody eventually, and Tumblr was certainly walking around with a big old target on its back. Evan, why don't you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, they, Perfect 10 is no stranger being a plaintiff in copyright litigation. It's sued, you know, the likes of, well, oh, you know, Google before for, you know, alleged infringement involving Google images. It's sued a CC bill, you know, for facilitating the payments for the receipt of infringing images, and even sued Mega Upload last year, which is kind of a story that went under the radar, at least on my radar screen. So they've sued Tumblr over the presence of what Perfect 10 says are infringing images that remain on the service, you know, despite the fact that Perfect 10 sent, I think it was a half dozen or so, DMCA takedown notices that apparently were disregarded. Tumblr didn't act to remove or disable access to that allegedly infringing content. Or maybe I didn't properly place where allegedly is there. It allegedly didn't remove that content. So, it should come as no surprise that Perfect 10 would take this position if there really is infringing content on there, and if believe it has the facts to support a claim of infringement, both either direct or secondarily against Tumblr. So it's one of those things. It's a situation where we'll get once again to see the contours of the protections of the DMCA safe harbors play out. And I'm sure we'll have some interesting facts. The biggest surprise to me was to learn that there's so much porn on Tumblr. I had no idea. It's not that I was going out looking for it. I wasn't necessarily trying to avoid it. But came as a big surprise to me to learn to read about that there is this underbelly, so that others have called, you know, of Tumblr that has a lot of porn on it. So, you know, you go looking for it and you'll find it. It's actually there. So it says a little bit. It adds another dimension to the nature of the platform, the kind of content that's there. So it'll be a fun one to watch.
Yeah, I wasn't sure there.
That is.
Yes. I wasn't sure there for a minute whether you were being ironic, like, ooh, who knew there's porn on Tumblr, or if you were genuinely surprised, which I actually was.
I actually was, too. I've been using Tumblr wrong this whole time, apparently. That's all I know. I've been making some horrible mistakes in my time on Tumblr.
I was surprised apparently. As well.
Now we know all have gotten a Tumblr how-to courtesy of Perfect 10. But I guess it does raise some interesting issues for the lawsuit because it brings up, you know, a whole Grokster-esque kind of scenario where the business model is something more nefarious than might meet the eye just at looking at the site. At least that's what's being alleged. Jonathan, any thoughts on this?
Several thoughts on this one. Perfect 10, I like to refer to them and as kind of the, lately I would say it's the Charlotte Bobcats of copyright. The lovable but plucky losers, if you will. Maybe not so lovable, but they've got a very long track record of being a plaintiff and losing quite regularly. But there's two things about this case that I find interesting. Kind of their MO with other DMCA cases they filed is they are complaining that they didn't receive takedown on DMCA notices they filed, that maybe the host should have been able to make a determination, but the DMCA itself wasn't what I would consider a best practice with an industry standard. This time around, though, they're claiming that some 25 other hosts had no problems and removed the content. So that's one potential angle, maybe showing that Perfect 10's doing a little more due diligence with the DMCAs. Unfortunately, I have not seen the actual notices they filed here. But the other thing I found interesting is most of their major losses have come out in California, the Ninth Circuit. By suing Tumblr, they're actually suing in New York. They're taking it to the Second Circuit, which has very different standards on DMCA compliance. So this one could be actually very interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. The Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit frequently come out with different kinds of verdicts in or results, if we're talking about at the appellate level, on the copyright front. Venkat, do you think that that could make a big difference here?
I think it could make somewhat of a difference, and I'm sure drove Perfect 10's choice to sue in the East Coast versus in the Ninth Circuit, which seems much more friendly to intermediaries. And I think one more thing to note is that, as Jonathan mentioned, Perfect 10's DMCA notices are often not compliant DMCA notices, and they don't satisfy all the DMCA requirements. And in fact, several of the cases they've lost have held that the DMCA notices Perfect 10 sent, you know, didn't contain the appropriate information. And they fought those battles pretty hard and ended up losing pretty much in the majority of the cases. I think one other point that this lawsuit raises separate from the DMCA is this whole issue of whether Perfect 10 can argue that Tumblr somehow induces infringement. So regardless of whether they have DMCA protection, whether they can be liable for the actions of their users. And that raises some interesting issues, but I think Perfect 10 has a tough time winning on that one, because the argument would be that Tumblr induced people to share images that they posted and reblog those images or content or whatever. But that's really what, so many sites are doing that today. It's such a widespread practice that I think a court would have a tough time saying that inducing your users to share somehow amounts to inducing infringement.
Well,
right. I think that is an interesting wrinkle that again brings the Grokster kind of liability into this DMCA oriented litigation. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Sorry, I was just going to say, they had another allegation in the lawsuit we didn't talk about. They are actually alleging, and if this sounds familiar to anyone, we'll know why instantly. They're also alleging, though, that in the early days of Tumblr, some of Tumblr's own employees posted images from Perfect 10 to help seed the site. And if that sounds like an echo of the Viacom YouTube case, congratulations, you win a prize. I'm going to be curious to see how that argument pans out as well. They're also going for direct infringement, I suppose.
Venkat, do you think Pinterest is next?
Well, I think Pinterest is should be worried about it. And to me, Pinterest is slightly different from Tumblr because Tumblr at least has the argument they could make that people could write their own microblog posts or upload their own photos, but Pinterest is basically you're on, as I understand it, I must confess I'm not a heavy Pinterest user. The entire structure of Pinterest is around sharing other people's stuff that you see on the web.
That's not quite right.
Okay. Well,
there's definitely a community sort of norm around that. There's a lot of that going on. But if what you want to share is original content, you can do that too.
Well, from what I've seen, and thanks for that clarification, but from what I've seen, the majority of Pinterest users really just repin other content. And I don't know if that will end up making a difference legally, but I'm sure a copyright plaintiff would make the argument based on percentages or something that, hey, 90% of the time people are just pinning other people's content. And, you know, that kind of goes into whether there are non-infringing uses and how much of the time users use Pinterest for non-infringing purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to suggest that Pinterest is at risk. I mean, I think if they have a DMCA policy and they reasonably enforce the policy and take down content, I think they can make a pretty strong argument that, you know, they're an intermediary, like much like Facebook and a lot of other sites are.
Yeah, right. And you were kind of, and maybe inadvertently, I doubt if it was inadvertent, you know what you're talking about, Venkat, you know, borrowing nomenclature, utilizing nomenclature from the Sony case to kind of intimate that the analysis would be whether Pinterest is capable of a non-infringing use. And, you know, in the situation that you're talking about, Venkat, where a plaintiff would come in and say, look at all these people who use Pinterest to infringe, that really would not be the analysis, because what the Sony test is to evaluate whether it's capable of a substantial non-infringing use, and regardless of whether it really is infringing at all. I mean, the VCR, everybody knows that 99.99% of the uses of the VCR is to infringe, you know, setting aside the fair use affirmative defense, which negates that, the question of liability. But, you know, the VCR still, you know, is okay under that doctrine of, because of being capable of a substantial non-infringing use. So I just thought that was an interesting point on how much can hang on that one word in the Sony test, be the capability of being non-infringing.
I would agree with that. You know, I think maybe my perspective is somewhat influenced by the fact that I use Tumblr, but I don't really use Pinterest, and I see it as something different, but you're right.
Hey, Venka, it's okay. You can admit you use Pinterest.
I've Jonathan seen you in there repinning all the little polyvore outfits. Come on.
Jonathan might make fun of you, but I'm not going to poke fun.
Well, and the other thing about Pinterest is, I don't know, I haven't looked at the facts on this, but was there something about how their images were stored? Are they all just stored at the same location and they're stored on Pinterest servers? Does anybody know anything about that? That affect?
Yeah, one of the, I guess, beefs a lot of content creators took with Pinterest was that they were copying the images, storing it on their own servers, or rather a content delivery network that they control in full size. So that was one of the issues, is that Pinterest does have all the images on their network.
And the other thing about Pinterest, not to beat up on Pinterest, I hope if they face a lawsuit, you know, they put together a defense, and I think they should be able to. But they had this thing with affiliate links where they changed affiliate links. And for a while, I think they might have changed this practice now, but they would insert their own affiliate links into content that people were pinning so that they generated maybe a larger portion of the revenue or a portion of the revenue from people who might click on, you know, Amazon links or something like that after they saw something on Pinterest. So I don't know how much that'll play into the analysis, but another fact to potentially consider.
So I've never affirmatively searched for pornographic images on Pinterest. They do have a report pin button prominently displayed every time you open one up. So I'm wondering if that will help, you know, fend off the likes of Perfect 10 at any rate, other porn kind of adult offerings. Although right now when I clicked over to it, I've got to say there is a picture of Shiri, a Japanese butt robot that responds to touch. So I don't know if that qualifies or not.
A Japanese what?
What? This is from Rusty Blazanoff at Laughing Squid, and it's a Japanese butt robot.
Good night, everybody. Best name
of
the
exactly.
show.
Using her,
everyone, go home.
Her nomenclature. So you'll have to check that out. I recommend following her on Pinterest. She's very funny, as is, of course, Laughing Squid all the time. So where was I going with this? So I think porn might be, you know, not so prominent there as to make that a big problem for them. Evan, what do you think about the credence of these allegations that Tumblr actually was ignoring or not properly responding to DMCA requests? That strikes me as hard to believe.
Yeah, well, I've got to answer you as soon as I recover from my Beavis moment after seeing that butt robot.
There you go. You can find all sorts of delightful things on Pinterest.
Jonathan was thinking if he had one of those, he would never leave the house. It's hard to believe that Pinterest or that Tumblr. Your question was about Tumblr, right?
Tumblr,
not responding to the DMCA takedown notice. I mean, it's not a new company. It's been around for 5 years. It has scaled well. It's successful, and all indications are that, you know, it's well managed and all that stuff. So that it would seem anomalous that they would consciously disregard a DMCA takedown notice, which, you know, would play. And this is probably the 110th time I've reminded listeners and viewers of the show that just because you don't comply with a DMCA takedown notice doesn't mean that you're automatically on the hook for the infringement that was done by your users, you know, if you're the intermediary. So I don't know. If it's only a half dozen DMCA takedown notices that they didn't comply with, I have no data on this, but I could only imagine that that is just a small fraction of 1% of the DMCA takedown notices that Tumblr gets. So they probably actually do have a good track record on complying with these things. All of this is contributing to what I, you know, really want to be saying about this is I find it pretty implausible that Tumblr would, you know, really be beyond the pale in not listening to valid DMCA takedown notices. It just seems like that seems like pretty hard to believe.
It does
to me too. Yeah,
Jonathan,
I would agree with that as well.
Beatmaster in IRC is prompting me that Facebook could be next with the new file sharing. Do you have any thoughts on that? First of all, you know, for anyone not familiar with what Beatmaster is alluding to, what is the new file sharing, and how could it subject Facebook to similar problems?
Yeah, I mean, I guess with the thing with Facebook, I mean, Facebook is obviously taking some proactive measures to avoid the liability, at least from the, I know that they're not allowing music files, right, or any kind of sound files to be traded through that. So ostensibly, they're trying to direct it to legitimate, you know, group-related activities that would not run afoul of copyright issues, you know, materials and things like that that are, you know, presumably done by the group. I guess one big challenge to this, that to the enforcement with Facebook's sharing is that these are all, that the sharing is done in silos, you know, in as much as the group is a secure environment that the prying eyes of a copyright plaintiff may not be able to get into very easily. This is much more akin to Dropbox or, you know, another file service, cloud-based service like that, than it is the trading of files on the open web, like with BitTorrent, or even more of the file lockers, like Hotfile and others like that. So there's a the new Facebook service seems to be kind of a little bit sui generis in that respect, kind of standing alone, unlike anything else, because it contains some of the elements of Dropbox, but also the sociality of it is more in its DNA, because heck, it's arising from Facebook after all. So there's some interesting things that differentiate that, but no question if there's infringement going on, there could be liability there. But who knows, again, how Facebook would be responsible for that.
Right. So the notion would be you get a small group together. If you can't share audio files, you can't turn it into sort of a DJ kind of experience.
No.
But you could, you know, create a mini Pinterest kind of environment. And yes, there might be the kind of technically qualifying copyright infringement that goes on there all the time with people sharing things in email or, you know, in a small, closed, password protected kind of online environment. If they're the thing that always occurs to me is I was planning an event at my son's school, and it was an art event. So we had to provide the teachers with photographs to inspire them, to inspire the students to do the art. And so we needed to share pictures of art. And I wish at the time, I guess Pinterest has been around for 5 years or so. I wish at the time I had been able to use such a great tool to easily aggregate images and share them with the faculty in advance of this event. But I wasn't on it and wasn't using it then. But, you know, the same kind of copyright issues would come to the fore no matter how you did it. So I guess the Facebook, you know, the Facebook kind of scenario is more the one that I would have engaged in with email and sharing it among a closed group of people that hopefully would never prompt in someone suing over such a thing, especially for educational purposes. But, you know, technically could raise some eyebrows and possibly somebody's hackles on the litigation front.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And really quickly, going back to Tumblr's compliance with the DMCA, I checked through my archives. I don't seem to have sent them one. They don't usually deal with the type of content I work with. So I have not had that opportunity, but I did some searching among some people I know and some general blogs. There have been a lot of complaints about Tumblr's DMCA policy, but nothing about them outright ignoring notices. More to do with the repeat infringer policy rather than simply just not responding to notices at all. So I'm finding the perfect 10 argument here even a little more odd.
Yep, indeed. Well, this is going to be a fun one to watch. The perfect 10 cases always are because they involve porn, and what could be better than that?
Venkat,
did you have a final thought?
I was going to say, is Tumblr based? I know they have investors in New York, but are they based in Northern California? And if they are, I wonder if there's some sort of form shopping argument that they may raise to say, hey, this dispute should be resolved in California and not New York.
I know this one. No.
Go ahead.
I looked this one up for the Copyright 2.0 show. Actually, we found out they are based in New York. Tumblr is based in New York State. So, yeah, they are actually suing them in their turf. So okay. Kind of hard to make a form shopping argument. It's just a convenient location, I think.
Yes. May well be for the plaintiff there. So we'll just have to see. The interesting article over on Forbes, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about HBO and Game of Thrones, originating from Torrent Freak, which tracks all this. It gives lists of the most pirated shows both on television and in the movie theaters, and puts out these annual lists. And Game of Thrones, I guess, is on its way to becoming the number one pirated show in America because it is, especially now that it's well into season two, unavailable if you're not a subscriber to HBO. And HBO's CEO has come out and said, well, we think that, you know, this whole internet streaming thing is just sort of a passing fad. And once that goes away, I'm sure that our revenue model will make sense again. I am paraphrasing, but he said this at a conference. And just kind of goes to show, you know, that they're reaping what they sow here. You know, of course, it's the most pirated show. It's very popular. It's available only if you subscribe to the network. And so it's going to be pirated.
Hey, Denise.
Yes.
You're popping and crackling there.
I'm popping and crackling. You want to call me back?
You're doing the Cyloning thing, so let me call you.
Okay. Alrighty.
Not in the breakdancing sense either.
Unfortunately.
Oh, that'd be all right.
The unlimited supply of Pop Rocks finally got to her.
Huh.
Here we go. I'm coming back.
And speak.
Hello. Speak.
That seems to work. Okay.
All right.
Now back to your regularly scheduled This Week in Law.
We'll pick it up. So, Evan, I'll ask you first. Do you think that, are you surprised at all that Game of Thrones is so widely pirated? And what do you think we can expect to happen next here?
I don't know what we can expect to happen next because this is all, I think, a moving target. I think I mean, this is one of those situations where it's really hard to get metrics on because it's a question of supply and demand, and there are internal forces affecting that supply and demand that really make it an amorphous kind of inquiry. I mean, is it that it's pirated because it is inherently good and the demand for it is high because of the content of the quality, or is it being pirated because of some scarcity that, not ironically, is brought about because, oh, you can only get it through these really, you know, through jumping through all these expensive, difficult hoops. So, you know, I'm not so sure that we can quickly and automatically say HBO is in the wrong because it's not making it available and that therefore HBO is responsible for the piracy of its own works. That seems like it could just as easily be seen as a result of its own success in terms of either the quality of the content or its distribution efforts to create this notion of scarcity of it, whether that's artificial or indeed authentic. So I leave it to people who enjoy the more, well, I don't know. I don't know how to describe the type of analysis. I've already called it amorphous, I think, moving targets. I guess I just don't find a whole lot of value in trying to really quantify that and to offer suggestions on the business model to the content producer and the content distributor here. You know, I'll leave it up to them to make those kinds of decisions and just kind of sit back here and make take pot shots at the analysis. That's where I can be.
Eric Kessler is HBO's co-president. And he was interviewed at Video Schmooze in New York, said that cord cutting has been minimal and largely the result of macroeconomic conditions, whatever that may mean. He, of course, has made the decision, and his company has made the decision not to offer HBO Go, their iPad app, to anyone beyond their realm of television HBO subscribers. So I was thinking, well, of course this means it's inevitable that people are going to start selling access to their HBO Go accounts. And I wondered, you know, just it's a matter of time. Well, it's not just a matter of time. I did a quick search on eBay last night and there was someone hawking their HBO Go access for $40 flat fee. You know, I'm sure that if HBO were to complain about that, that auction would get pulled down. But, you know, there's going to be a market for these things. Certainly. Jonathan, any thoughts?
You know, I actually agree a lot with Evan here. There are about a million factors that go into determining how much something is pirated. Popularity, accessibility, price, the audience, things targeted at younger audiences tend to get pirated more, subject matter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a million different variables. Availability is truly just one. It is an important one. It's an important one, but it's not the only one. However, HBO took a look at their numbers. They took a look at the information they had, and they made a decision. They said that, yes, going this route has a risk of increased piracy, will mean an increase in piracy. But as part of doing that, you know, we think we can get more money through these streams here and through these systems here, despite that risk of piracy. And they've made that choice. And whether or not, you know, I agree with it or not is kind of irrelevant because it's going to wind up being the market that decides it. And if in the end, if everyone decides that they're going to pirate HBO and not pay for it, well, I don't think that's an ethical decision. I don't think anyone should do that. You know, I think you should vote by basically not giving money and not pirating. But, you know, it's going to be the audience that votes. And, you know, the people with the best business model are going to win at the end of the day. So I'm going to be curious to follow this experiment, kind of like I've been curious to follow the paywall experiments of various newspapers. It's another approach to this, and I may not like it. I may not agree with it because I'd like to watch me some Game of Thrones, too. I haven't even seen a single episode. But there you go. They made their choice, and all we can do is watch.
So we have an intern now at This Week in Law for the summer, Franklin Graves. He's going to law school in Nashville, Tennessee. And he actually had some thoughts on this story. He was reading through and digesting and wondering about the fact that it seemed to be coming through loud and clear that people feel that they have the right to get at this content in a freer, more convenient way than HBO is making it available. And he wonders if it's right for people to feel that way. What do you think, Venkat?
I think it's wrong, basically, and I would mostly agree with Evan and Jonathan in that even the premise of this article rubs me the wrong way. It's almost like the version of these far out and left field RIAA arguments, but on the other side that says, okay, if HBO doesn't make it available, therefore they're to blame for the piracy that results, regardless of the numbers. I feel like it doesn't feel like it really moves the conversation, and I just kind of question it at the basic level. So I would agree that the users don't have the right. I mean, it's up to HBO to say if we want to make it available, you know, in a certain format, and we don't want to make it available to cord cutters, that's fine. And there's no real reason why cord cutters should have the inherent right to go out and say we should be able to access it on our iPads. That sounds ludicrous to me.
I'm with you, but I think that, you know, it's the same. It's the music industry all over again. It's people saying, you know what, that is such a bad business model that we're just not going to respect it. You know, we're gonna have to just tell you that you're wrong, and we're going to tell you in ways that damage your business. You agree, Evan?
And to me, if I may interject, I think that's precisely the problem. I think that users can say you're wrong, but not by going out and pirating the HBO show. I think the way to do it is just to watch something else. I mean, watch the stuff that's on YouTube that's web content. And obviously people aren't doing that.
I tell people all the time, vote with your dollar. Vote for the business model you want with your money. If you like what Netflix is doing, buy an account. Pay. Watch that. You know, buy the Hulu Plus if that's what floats your boat. Support the people who are doing what you like and doing what you think is good, and don't pirate the ones that you think are doing something bad, because that's giving them ammunition to go past stronger laws. That's, you know, part of how they go and they promote SOPA and PIPA and that type of stuff. You're just helping them get stronger enforcement measures before Congress.
I think the thing that I like about this issue is that it brings in pretty sharp focus, or at least within the crosshairs of our analysis, what the real public interest what is the public interest that is served by copyright protection and the right and ability of the copyright owner to determine how its content is going to be distributed, what content is going to be distributed and how it's distributed. And, you know, and the other side of that coin is the, you know, what rights do the consumers of that content have to get it? And it's one of those situations where if you start the analysis with the premises that the public interest is served by the widest possible distribution of content, you're going to be able to support either side of this argument. It's very easy for the proponents, or how should we characterize them? Those who are lampooning HBO and the difficulties that it's putting up, it's easy for them to say, oh, you know, all of these obstacles stand in the way of me getting to it, and I can even break the law in rebellion or in some form of civil disobedience toward your draconian policies, content owner. Well, you know, the content owner on the same side can say, look, I'm going to take like more of a natural rights theory here, that, you know, that you know, to every cow her calf, and that this content that I have invested in so dutifully and lovingly created, you know, I have every right to determine how that is distributed. I have the right to determine who gets it. I have the right to determine on what terms it's gotten there. And if we abide by those principles and recognize those rights of the content owner, the content owner is going to be the most fully incented to distribute that in the most economical way. And I don't think that there's much argument that then that's going to facilitate and encourage the widest possible distribution of that. So I don't know how to resolve all of these things, but I think we just need to be very measured and very careful in the analysis. I'm not suggesting anybody in this conversation is off the mark in their analysis and all this, but anybody who's examining this really has to keep front and center the idea of how the public interest and our culture and our heritage is enriched by the enforcement of copyright mechanisms in whatever form they may exist as we go through time.
So in having some of these discussions over on Google Plus this week, someone told me that they pirated something, but they checked in via Get Glue. Does anybody know what that is? Maybe he meant Get Clue. I mean, is this some sort of mechanism where people are declaring their piracy in order to tell the content industry that that they're messing up? I'm being told it's an app, both by IRC and the studio.
I think it's a social TV watching app where you can check in and watch shows.
It's like Foursquare for content.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it doesn't... It tells that the show is being watched, but it's not telling how it was obtained. I think it's all very interesting.
You could always add your commentary to it, you know, in as much as you can add, you know, like, you know, say something about it. So, yeah, I mean, it's clearly a platform to verbalize these things. And it would be, you know, pretty damning evidence if you ever sued for infringement. There would be some interesting discovery of your Get Glue information to, you know, as an admission to, oh, yeah, I was pirating. Seems kind of foolish to me. Whatever perspective you take.
Right. I'd love to see, you know, Torrent Freak does these great analyses and tracking of this kind of information. I'd love to see not just, you know, what are the most pirated shows, but which shows are most often viewed via piracy, if that makes sense. Like, for example, I think Sherlock is probably watched in pirated form a lot, especially right now, because season two is going, and again, it's one of those things that you either wait for it to come out on PBS or you don't watch it in the US. There's no other way to get at it for season two, at least not that I've been able to unearth. And so I'm guessing the piracy rate on those is going to be enormous, but I don't think anybody's necessarily tracking that. So that would be an interesting bit of data to have. Hey, Evan, how did we manage to get to be almost 6 years old as a show? And it didn't even occur to us. We're just now getting our first intern, and that was because Franklin suggested it.
I know that was a great suggestion on his part. It's going to be really nice to have him around, and it's going to be really helpful because, you know, there's so much information that you and I, you know, make ourselves responsible for getting our minds around each week. So, you know, making that more efficient is going to be a huge help. So I'm really looking forward to having him contribute to the noble effort that is this show.
Me too. It's a fabulous idea. Thank you, Franklin, for suggesting it and for joining us. We have him working away probably even as we speak.
Oh, I'm sure.
Okay, well, I want to talk about the great vigilante of social networking justice, Twitter, in a moment. But before we do that, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is ShareFile. Now, we've been talking all around in this story about the need to share large files. Hopefully, the need to share large files that aren't infringing people's copyrights or otherwise going to get you in hot water. But the fact is, we have great big bits of media that we need to get around, and there are services out there like Dropbox and Google Drive and various other things that are publicly available but may not be the business solution that you need. In business, you really have to have something that runs efficiently, that can handle large or confidential documents and presentations and get them to clients immediately and reliably. You need to be able to collaborate on those files with colleagues and business partners easily and securely and work effectively away from your office by accessing those files from any computer or mobile device anytime. That's why we're highly recommending ShareFile by Citrix. It's a secure file sharing solution built specifically for a business, a powerful tool that helps your business run smoothly. You can send files of almost any size without the frustration of bounce backs. You can collaborate on files securely and completely under your control. And it's the perfect solution to doing business in today's digital world. My personal thoughts about ShareFile are that they have really thought this through. They have, for all the folks out there who use Outlook in connection with your business, and you are legion, I know it, there is a plugin for Outlook that makes it seamless. As soon as you have one of these big files, instead of just attaching it to an email, which isn't going to work anyway, you click on the share add to share file button that right there in your email creation screen, and it sets it up right there for you. It puts the secure link into your email. You can fine-tune exactly who can see what you're sharing, for how often, for how long, the duration that they'll have access, et cetera. You can also customize this very nicely to your business environment. So there's seamless brand recognition between what else you're doing online, your any other kind of communication graphics that you use. You can integrate that with ShareFile as well. And folks aren't even probably going to realize that they're using a service that you're not hosting yourself. It's really wonderful. And don't just take my word for it, because we have a great offer for you. It's completely without risk. You can sign up for 30 days of this service plus double storage. So you can really get in and see how much it can handle. You can get that by visiting ShareFile.com, clicking on the radio microphone that you see there and entering the promo code TWIL, T-W-I-L. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Law. All right, guys. Well, Twitter is at it again. They are once again doing what we've come to expect from them. When somebody wants to find out what one of their users are doing and there are issues about whether that information should be disclosed and it's the government doing the searching and there are free speech issues involved, Twitter seems to always rise to the occasion and do what I would consider the right thing and at least make the government jump through all possible hoops before turning over that information. Evan, can you give us a bit more detail on what happened here?
Well, this had to do with the investigation into the Occupy Wall Street protests. The cops said that there was there were some people blocking the Brooklyn Bridge last year, and so the authorities wanted to get at this guy's Twitter account information. He moved to quash that, I guess it was a 2703D order under the Stored Communications Act, I think. The feds tried to get at the information, or the government. I think it was. Getting confused now. I don't think it was the federal government, but in any event, Twitter stepped in after the individual Twitter users' efforts at stopping the disclosure of information were unsuccessful. So everybody is lauding Twitter and saying, "Oh, you know, it cares about its users. It cares about user privacy." You know, I guess I won't disagree with that. You know, AMAC, Alex McGilvary, Twitter's general counsel, is a friend of the show. And so, you know, I'll say, you know, I trust that he was making the good decisions and, you know, was instrumental in the developing Twitter's attitude and approach to that. So I'll only say good things about it. But I'll also point out that, you know, this is certainly in Twitter's best interest to preserve its public image as one who will stand up for the privacy rights of its users. And with, what is it, some, you know, I think it's just somewhere south of 200 million users, Twitter would go bankrupt quickly if it were to litigate every matter in which information was sought about its users. So we have to assume that there are plenty of instances where it's fully cooperative in situations, even where it may have a legitimate argument against turning over this information. I suppose it's no coincidence that the situation where they would get involved and make a stand like this, it's really happened two times. One was with WikiLeaks and the disclosure there. Second time now is with Occupy Wall Street stuff. These are very closely watched situations where they can get a lot of mileage from a public relations standpoint in stepping forward here and defending the privacy rights of their users, get a lot of mileage, a lot of bang for the buck. If it was just some random petty criminal out there who was, you know, trying to fight disclosure of his information, you know, I don't think Twitter would be as want to do that. All of this, you know, just to reiterate, I'm not saying anything bad about Twitter. I think it's noble. I think it's good. I think in general, there should always be the full set of due process procedures in place to ensure the privacy of individual users. It's just that, you know, this situation has plenty of ways that it contributes to Twitter's self-interest as well. It's not completely altruistic for the sake of its individual user in this, but it's still laudatory.
Yes, you're a skeptic, Evan. I do like that about you. I haven't read through the New York State court filings, but apparently, sort of reading between the lines of the coverage, there was an investigation into the protesters that I'm guessing was for state criminal proceedings, and Twitter was likely asked for this information or subpoenaed. And did not comply, and then the prosecution involved the state court to order them to hand over the information, and now Twitter has moved to quash. Either that or the motion to quash is just for the subpoena itself, and the only involvement of the court is that, you know, it's technically the body standing behind the subpoena. Any thoughts on this, Jonathan?
I have to agree with Evan in that I'm a little bit skeptical of the, I guess you would say, the motive of Twitter. I do think it came from a good place in the heart. I'm not saying they're an unethical company, but obviously they've chosen their battles very carefully. I can imagine they don't put up this kind of fight for every Twitter user. They're picking their battles according to what they think is A, most important and most urgent to them, and also B, what is most in line with the public image they're trying to present themselves as. And, you know, one of the things, ever since, like, the Arab Spring and so forth, they've kind of earned a reputation, maybe justly or unjustly, as this sort of this safe haven for government, for protesters of governments and against government oppression for protesters. And so it makes sense that they would work in court to preserve that, at least take, you know, small steps like this to do it. It just seems quite logical.
It's kind of weird to me what this prosecutor is looking for from Twitter. I mean, they know the person's name. Presumably, they don't have, you know, they have the resources to put that together with anything else they would need as far as identity, location, to be able to prosecute him.
Denise.
Yes.
They're subpoenaing Twitter. Obviously, what they need to know is what he had for breakfast and what his dog did to that day that was funny. That's the only
reason. But we all already know that, right? It's public.
Maybe it was a private account. You don't know, okay?
You're right. Maybe it was a private account. Venkat, any thoughts?
I would agree, and I think Twitter should be lauded. You know, anytime anybody makes it harder for the government to get information, that's not necessarily a bad thing. At the same time, I think if the person had a public Twitter account, it's somewhat strange to say that their public tweets shouldn't be turned over. And I think it's worth kind of separating exactly what information Twitter is being asked to turn over, whether it's the direct messages, the location IP mm-hmm. address to put together a location profile,
sure.
or the registration information. And as you mentioned, a lot of the information is probably public or in the hands of the prosecutor anyway. So it looks like Twitter's just fighting a procedural battle that they may end up winning to make the government jump through more hoops or jump through the appropriate hoops when they ask for information from a Twitter user. And my recollection was that they lost the battle on the WikiLeaks issue, and that was primarily based on the court's conclusion that Twitter users, you know, turn their information over to a third party, Twitter, and in their terms of use pretty much agree that, you know, users don't have control over the information. So I'm curious to see how it comes out, but
yeah.
it's Twitter gets kudos for fighting the battle.
It's worth mentioning too that even as to the public tweets, and I'm sort of scoffing saying, you know, what are you trying to get at? It was all public, but it does you know, it lives on Twitter in a reasonably limited temporal way, and then, you know, is going to be out of various search caches in a while. And if nobody has bothered to keep track of it, Twitter may be the only source of that information that the prosecutors now decide they need. So it could actually be the content as well as IP addresses and the rest.
Especially if the tweets.
There's always the Library of Congress as well as an option. Because I understand the Library of Congress is supposed to archive tweets, but.
Yes, and I'm unaware of the status of that. You know, there was a lot of publicity about it, and then it was for research purposes, and who knows, you know, if a state prosecutor is considered a valid researcher for Library of Congress purposes. I'm not even sure, you know, how far into that project they are at this point. It's been at least a year or so since it's been announced. So, but it seems to be not something the public can exploit to any kind of useful way at the moment. Let us talk, since we're talking about Twitter, Venkat, one of the things that you submitted for us was a law review article that I glanced at, but looks very interesting, by a person at Berkeley, my alma mater, suggesting that tweets themselves should be viewed askance in a way that suggests that they should be assumed to be not true for purposes of defamation law. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. In a pretty interesting short 5-page article that I think is well worth reading, the thrust of the article is that Twitter is used as a medium for casual conversation, and courts look to context in other areas to determine whether a statement is defamatory or is amounts to libel. So in the case of tweets, such as including Courtney Love's famous defamation case that never went to trial, the author's point was courts should take a default position almost. He didn't come right out and say this, but his thrust was, you know, people don't take tweets seriously, so it's tough to defame somebody in 140 characters.
What do you think about that? Do you agree?
I'm on the fence. I think that, you know, I'm a pretty avid Twitter user. I use it a lot for news and current events, and I think people do take what they see on Twitter seriously, or at least a chunk of people do. There's a huge faction of Twitter that is comedic and involves parody and a lot of banter, but then there's also a big chunk of Twitter that is serious communication that a lot of people would understand to be factual. I mean, famous events and news have broken on Twitter. We read about that all the time or hear about it or see it on Twitter. And so I'm not sure I think a default rule makes sense that, you know, everyone takes tweets unseriously and therefore the burden should be on the plaintiff to show that a tweet in a particular case was defamatory. And I also think that there's a lot of the author also looks to blog postings and chat rooms and statements made in those contexts to say that, you know, maybe courts are treating those statements as not always defamatory. And there's some truth to that, but at the same time, I think we've seen numerous examples of blog posts that have resulted in pretty serious awards for defamation. So I don't know that people look to online communications as somehow less serious than offline communications. And I think it depends on context in much the same way that it would if we're having a conversation in a, you know, in a bar or over dinner and we're just joking around. That might not be defamatory, but at the same time, you know, conversation can definitely be defamatory, and there's nothing about 140 character limitation that means that it's always a joke. So that's my thinking.
Right. I'm not a big fan of espousing Twitter exceptionalism. Everything you just said that was asserted in the article could apply to the web at large, right? People yeah. sort of take it with a grain of salt, or they should, and, you know, can't trust everything you read on the internet. So treating Twitter differently doesn't seem to make sense. What do you think, Evan?
I think it points to a larger principle, a larger issue, and that is, what is the appropriate context in which to interpret content that is alleged to be defamatory? And there's already a pretty good framework in the law of defamation to that, or a path that's already there that we can walk down in light of this context. It's clearly, in most jurisdictions, a defense to a defamation claim, for example, if it's mere opinion, or if I know Illinois in particular is big on the defense of if the statement is reasonably subject to a non-defamatory interpretation. So, you know, the fact that it's on the web, more specifically, the fact that it's on Twitter, which is by its very nature, as we just you know, we're recently discussing is ephemeral. These things don't hang around for very long. They're by necessity very short. There's only so much information that can be put in there. You know, that in and of itself really has to establish the context that makes the assertion of these defenses easier and more applicable to the situation. That, you know, like I said, it's pointing toward the direction of that principle. It would be dangerous, and I'm not sure that the article necessarily does establish a per se rule or per se default setting toward saying that if it's on Twitter, it's not defamatory, and that's our starting point. But, you know, it does... It certainly is not irrelevant that it's on Twitter or any kind of ephemeral social media in making the analysis. And I think it's an important thing to keep in mind.
So this is kind of related, Venkat. You also threw in front of our panel this week an article by Jeffrey Hermes over at the Citizen Media Law Project about measuring social media damages. Should defamation damages be treated differently when social media is involved? What's the crux here?
I think that's another very interesting article that talks about how often in these defamation cases, there are multiple repeating communications. And the author's point was, you know, we've seen some astronomical damage awards involving multiple blog posts. And there's a question as to how much of the award was really intended to repair reputational damage versus how much of it is intended as punishment for the speaker. And one of the interesting points that the author makes is that, you know, when you have successive blog posts, if somebody posts 20, 30, 40 times about somebody over time, do the readers sort of start to discount the posts? And is it actually kind of counterproductive from the speaker's standpoint? And should that be taken into account in doling out defamation awards? And my take on that, or I guess the author's take on that, which is that it's tough to measure because the jury's, it's kind of left open to a jury. And oftentimes the jury might split reputational harm from punitive damages, but it's the two blend together. And so I think it raises a pretty interesting point around defamation and online communications in general, much like the Twitter article.
Yeah, it sure does. And one of the things that comes up in defamation cases all the time as far as calculating damages is whether or not you're a public figure. And of course, that's vastly complicated by social media. You have what X number of followers or how many circles do you need to be in before you're considered a public figure for these cases. Jonathan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Let's just see how long
Jonathan, I believe you've muted yourself.
Sorry, I apologize. No, but real quick, going back to the previous article about Twitter not being liable, real fast, I have a tweet queued up at dhowell, at internet cases, and at and that, well, Venkat's name, I can't see your last name. but the three of you, rob banks and beat up grandmothers, hashtag tweets are not liable. So we'll see how long it is till one of the three of you come after me.
Ha-ha.
Let's put this to bed right now. I've got you where I want you.
A test case in the making.
Exactly. I like to be the pioneer in these matters, if you will.
The truth is a defense, too.
Exactly. But but no, regarding being a public figure, I've always found that pretty interesting because, you know, it used to be it was a pretty clear divide when you interjected yourself into a public debate or when you did something to put yourself out there in the public light, you were a public figure. There was a pretty clear line there. And I even remember when I was in college, you know, we're talking, you know, too many years ago. Let's not go into that. But fairly recently still, that was, you know, a very simple discussion about when one was or was not a public figure. But these days, like you said, it's hopelessly complicated because we're all on Facebook, we're all on Twitter, we're all on this, we're all on that. And every day we're interjecting ourselves into various debates online. We're participating in forums. We're talking about things on social media. We're leaving comments on blogs. So at what point do you cross that threshold from being a private citizen to a public figure? What? There's no clear action anymore. And for matters of defamation, that's going to be a very thorny issue. That since defamation law is decided largely by the states, it's going to take a long, long time for that settled out. But, I mean, I don't think we've really seen a good test case here as to when maybe you guys can correct me, but when a good test case that's centered around when someone puts themselves out there online enough to be considered a public figure.
Right, because it impacts the level of proof that the plaintiff has to come forward with.
Proof and damages both, yeah.
Yeah, as well. So you would think that would come up early on in a defamation case. But like you, I can't, you know, think of a good test case that has pushed that yet. I'm sure we're going to have one, though. Evan, have you seen anything?
Wasn't there something with Cindy Sheehan? She was the infamous... We've even talked about her on the show because I remember saying this before, that she hated George Bush more than any person on the face of the earth. I thought there was some controversy over her and whether she was a public figure or something like that. So the real answer to your question is I'm not aware of anything in particular. But, you know, with the ability to effectively promote oneself and to interject oneself into a public controversy as to affect its outcome or to try to affect the outcome, there's no doubt that the instrumentalities we have available to communicate and get a message out to a lot of people should affect that analysis of what it means to at least be a limited public figure. And no doubt it's a more complicated analysis than what it would have been in an old media kind of world. So who knows?
Right. Well, you're digging back to 2005, Evan, where there were analyses going on of whether Cindy Sheehan was a public figure or not. And I just quickly pulled up a blog post of someone positing that she was a limited purpose public figure, given her engagement in various public online activities. So
I guess you could always take the modern context and try to find more current examples. I mean, the thing that's coming to mind now maybe might be the I hate to do this because I was an example I was getting ready to use was actually somebody who contacted me to represent them. So it's a bad example. But maybe another example would be like the people involved in the Trayvon Martin situation, where it's a situation where you're thrust into a particular controversy, you know, you don't really have the choice. Like maybe Trayvon Martin's parents or something like that. You know, where they really have no choice. But if they're going to make a public stance towards something, there's that aspect of it too, where you really have no choice but to become a public figure, but you're still a limited purpose public figure for.
Right.
And exactly. the whole import of this, we haven't even mentioned that, is that makes the standard different to go after somebody as a plaintiff if you are a public figure, because then you have to show that the statement was made with actual malice, which is a harder case to win. That's the whole point of this inquiry of whether you're a public figure. And so the sum total of the analysis is, defamation victories should be less frequent if more people are considered public figures or limited public figures.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or another possible example, and as far as I know, there's no defamation action pending, but she's certainly somebody who may have not nice things said about her, is the woman on Time Magazine this week breastfeeding her almost 3-year-old son. She's 26-year-old Jamie Lynn Grumet, who is an adherent to attachment parenting. And, you know, that attachment parenting on its own can get people into all kinds of debates. And when you put yourself and your son out there on Time Magazine, I'm sure she's going to have some not very pleasant things said about her, unfortunately. So again, you know, is she a public figure because she agreed to be on Time, or was she kind of dragged into this? We shall see. Okay, so there is much else to talk about. How about, I thought it was interesting that just to check in with Sean Parker and Sean Fanning and see that the two of them have joined forces and are about to launch something new called Airtime. It looks like it's going to be a video kind of application. Details are limited at this point and will be more forthcoming on June 5th.
But it's not just a chat roulette clone, I trust.
So we don't know, but it's
pretty unawesome.
I know that, you know, Sean Parker has been out there doing many a thing since Napster. I wasn't sure whether Sean Fanning was involved in the newer iteration of Napster, the for-pay legal version, or not. But they definitely are, you know, using their brand awareness, if you will, to plug their new application or whatever it's going to be, service product. Any quick thoughts on the return of the Napster boys, Jonathan?
We know absolutely nothing about what they're trying to do other than they have terrible taste in fonts.
there we go.
I've got
yes.
a logo. That's it.
They do?
I've got a logo.
They've got a logo and a press event. So
And on June 5th.
What else
so
do you
talk
need?
To me on June 6th. We'll come back to it then.
Right, exactly. How about lifejacking? We have a case in Washington State, I believe. Let me, I just lost my place in the rundown here.
Yeah, it's the Attorney General.
That's right, Denise.
Yes. Where, let's see, did we have a plea in the case? What exactly happened here, Venkat?
Basically, Washington's state attorney general, the state of Washington, went after AdSend Media. Mm-hmm. That an AdSend was accused of likejacking. And what that entailed is to basically get people to like a page and then use that to essentially spam all their friends, all the person who liked that page's friends. And the Washington attorney general said this violated CAN spam, sued or threatened to sue, and eventually entered into a consent decree under which AdSend paid $100,000 in attorney's fees to Rob McKenna, who's Washington's attorney general, and agreed to take certain remedial steps to police affiliates who engaged in these activities. And separately, Facebook had also sued AdSend, and it was clear, obviously it was very public, that the Facebook and Washington's attorney general worked together, and I think Facebook and AdSend reached a settlement a couple of weeks back, the terms of which were not made public, as far as I understand.
So let's make this practical for people. Evan, you know, obviously people are constantly going around pitching you to like them or like their business on Facebook. When do you cross the line from sort of annoying marketing pitch into likejacking?
Probably at the same point where something might go from puffery to actionable misrepresentation in a in advertising,
oh,
something like that.
Great answer, Evan.
So clear yeah. now. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm really trying to be the master of information, you know, of tautologies, you know, answers that are words but really convey no information to you whatsoever. But
I think you managed it. Yes, thank you.
I mean, it has to do with expectations. All seriousness aside, you know, it has to do with expectations and when the expectation of the user it does not match up with the reality of what came about it. How's this for another answer that has no? I give up. I don't know.
Can you save us?
Absolutely not, but I can try. I mean, I think Evan's got a point that it's about expectations. When people like a page on Facebook, there's kind of, you know, a reasonable expectation there of how that page is going to behave and what it's going to do. You don't expect it to send you 10,000 links in a day and completely fill up your feed. You don't expect it to spam all of your friends and use you to get to them. And the same thing actually goes not just for liking a page, but for any time you connect, you know, Facebook to an app or to a website in any regard. I mean, it's any time you connect Facebook to absolutely anything. You have reasonable expectations, and Facebook's made some steps here. They've outlined in the every time you go to like something or to connect it, they have that little checklist of things it can and can't do that, to me, just further muddles it sometimes because it sometimes can be a very intimidating and long list that isn't very clear. But Facebook's made some progress here, But the idea is that we've come as a community, I think, to have expectations. And maybe we need some cases like this to help codify those expectations in the law, because that's how a lot of law winds up being written, actually.
And Kat, does this relate in any way to likes and free speech?
That's a good good question. And I think you're referring to a case that was handed down a couple of weeks ago in Virginia where a sheriff's deputy was fired for liking his opponent's Facebook page and making comments on that Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And the court there concluded that merely liking somebody's Facebook page is not First Amendment protected speech because it's essentially meaningless. And there was a lot of criticism of that decision, and it's going to be appealed, and I don't know how it's going to resolve, but it does. And I think you raise a good point, which I didn't consider when I blogged about the case, which is that, you know, my view of the sheriff's case was that liking somebody or liking a page or a brand or a cause is undeniably an expression to your friends, a public expression that should be expressive in much the same way flag burning or wearing a black armband should be. But maybe that's not the case. I mean, in this case kind of shows that people blindly like stuff that maybe they're not really thinking through what they like, and they're just clicking the button and spamming everybody on their friends list. Two other points I quickly wanted to make about this, coming back to your first question, is that how this quote-unquote like-jacking scheme was perpetrated was that one example I saw was that friends were presented with a video and said, click on this age verification to like this page or to watch the video, not even to like the page. And so I think people clicked on the button to watch the video, and it was essentially a disguised like button. So by clicking on the age verification, what they did was essentially like the page. So this really goes to the extreme of, you know, what might be misleading and whether or not reasonable people would like a page. And the other issue is that the Washington State Attorney General brought the complaint based on canned spam. And I've raised this question before, which is, you know, is a Facebook message really covered by canned spam? And to me, the answer is less than clear. And this case really demonstrates that, because canned spam looks to an email message and it's clearly designed to regulate email messages, and it talks about subject lines and headers and all these attributes of email messages. But for a Facebook message, it doesn't really track well. And, you know, there's no designated subject line as such. There's no header information in the same way that there is for an email. And it somewhat illustrates the difficulty in bringing old laws. It's hard to believe canned spam is old, even though it was passed, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, to bear on new forms of communication. So I think that's somewhat of an interesting issue, is whether Facebook messages or even should be regulated by canned spam.
Old laws.
That is interesting. Go ahead, Jonathan.
The DMCA was passed in 98. Think about that one. That was passed when GeoCities was a thing still, when people actually used it.
True.
Yeah, I mean, that's considered new in internet law.
That's considered recent.
Yes.
It's just proof of the evolution of the internet, how quick it is and how it's outpacing law. One thing that Venkat had me thinking about, though, when he was talking about the age verification trick, was if you're over the age of 18, how many of you just automatically and without even thinking click age verification links anytime you're asked to? Because now everything has it, like even movie trailers have it. Mm-hmm. And so it's like an automatic reflex. I'm old enough. Oh, no.
Right.
So that's how I would disguise anything, is as an age verification, literally. If I was going to hide or link jack, spam jack, whatever, car jack, I would do it by a age verification process. That's pretty ingenious, actually.
And this situation, I mean, what a sad statement. It's just out and out fraud to, you know, masquerade, yes, you're going to like our page on Facebook under an age verification button. What a sad statement that, you know, Facebook likes have become so valuable that someone would engage in that kind of activity to obtain them. It's kind of an interesting economic and social comment there. We like to talk about how automation affects our lives and our laws, and how they evolve to embrace the increasing automation in our world. So I threw in a story here about the state of Nevada, which is the first to have passed laws allowing Google's self-driving car to self-drive itself around. So if you're interested in having yourself chauffeured about by one of Google's cars, Nevada would be a good place to go. They have their own license plates issued by the state and can now drive around with impunity. Evan, what do you think about the robot cars in Nevada?
I was just wondering what it would look to be driving around with impunity. What, would she sit in the front seat with you, or would she have to sit in the back seat, or what does she look like?
I don't know.
She always rides shotgun.
Wait a minute. Impunity, if you're in Nevada, there's a good chance it's a prostitute in one of the legal brothels. I'm just saying, with a name like that. Oh, I'm just with impunity. It's okay.
I just need to see some papers, that's all. I totally forget what your question was, Denise. I was.
Nevada, self-driving cars, they're legal there now. Is this scary, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, doesn't the government always watch out for our best interest? And there's no way that they would issue a license for a technology that's not safe. So, you know, I have just a blind faith for the scruples of the Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles. And so I'm fine. I'll gladly walk as a pedestrian in Nevada any day of the week.
That's right. Legalized gambling, prostitution, and self-driving cars. It should be the state motto.
Right.
Venkat?
I'm enthusiastic, cautiously, about self-driving cars. I think you hear about a lot of technologies that are going to transform our lives, and I wonder, you know, I don't know that we've really seen any in the past 5 years, other than say Facebook or Twitter, that are more socially transformative and not transformative in the way that teleportation is, for example. So I keep thinking this could be the one that Google actually comes out with that, you know, that works, that people start using. And I think it would be really fun to see how it pans out. And all the legal issues are obviously interesting surrounding it.
That was really awesome how you just worked teleportation right into the middle of it and really took me by surprise.
Well, I guess fine. You hear about these things like invisibility cloaks and, you know, all these things that are right around the corner. And it's like, you know, after reading 50 articles, I'm just thinking, you know, my life's the same. I order stuff on Amazon. Sure, that's a convenience, but compared to 10 years ago, I don't know how much more fundamentally convenient life has become. And I think it's maybe the self-driving car is it. You know, I won't have to hire a chauffeur. I can just take a self-driving car.
You can fire until your current chauffeur.
Until at any event, exactly. you can teleport with impunity.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, I gotta say, I don't have any personal experience with Google's self-driving cars, but I'm a cautious believer in these technologies, and I'm glad, you know, at least one state has been brave enough to subject its citizenry to be sort of the beta lab for them.
Did you see the video Google posted some time ago showing off their self-driving car where they had a blind person going through a drive-through and all that stuff? It's actually amazing technology.
Having just bought a new Ford this year, just in the last couple of months, I am amazed at what the non-self-driving cars can do. There are sensors all over my car that tell me if someone
has...
They're
telling you what to say, what to do, and...
No, that's only when I ride with impunity. She's very bossy that way.
Can you access Facebook from your new Ford, Denise?
I cannot, and that's a good thing. But, you know, just from the driving safety standpoint, my car will parallel park itself. If someone slams on their brakes in front of me, my car has this terrible awful red lights, alarm, danger, Will Robinson thing that happens, so that you absolutely, if you're not paying attention, you will slam on your brakes too and make sure, you know, I guess the person behind you who doesn't have the good technology will slam right into you. But
then you're not responsible. That's the beauty of it. Rear end collision.
Exactly. But it's pretty amazing just what, you know, I haven't driven, I guess, a new car in a long time. And it's pretty amazing to me how far they have come in automation just in general. And I think Ford is probably, you know, one of the leaders in that area. So, I mean, that's why one of the reasons I picked the car in general, in particular.
You still have to deal with LA traffic, right?
Yes, but when I'm in LA traffic, again, you know, it's almost a self-driving feature. They have this thing called adaptive cruise control where it will adjust to keep the buffer between you and the car in front of you. So it adjusts the speed, including braking when it needs to, when you're out on the highways driving. So if someone cuts you off, you immediately fall back without you having to do anything other than steer, which is, you know, not too far from self-driving. So I'm sure that Google has done some good work there, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, God, I hope their little cars don't start just picking off pedestrians in Nevada. But
it would be really funny if Skynet starts out as the network of Google self-drivable cars, and it's like automatic death race 2000. All the cars are driving around Nevada.
That's right. Well, here I am cautiously optimistic about all this when, you know, computers are just as reliable as this following story. When you have 1,200 jurors show up for jury duty in LA, that's like a normal day's jury call almost. But when it happens in Placer County, that can only be the result of a computer glitch. And that's what happened here. I'm sure tiny little courthouse in Placer County sent 1,200 people there to knock on the door and show up for jury duty one morning. That would have been an interesting day at court. Evan, you submitted this one. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah. I mean, anytime I read a story about a computer problem causing, you know, having consequences in the material, real world, I'm always reminded of the importance of a provision that's critical in drafting a software license, and that is the limitation on liability. You know, the provision in the software contract that says we as the provider of this software aren't going to be liable to you, customer, if, you know, this application that we're providing to you breaks and you miss out on $10 million worth of sales over the next weekend. You can only sue us for what you paid for the software. So I was just reminded of this when it's so interesting how a little, you know, some sort of glitch or some kind of bug or whatever can bring 1,200 people converging on one place in time. That's pretty amazing how such a immaterial thing can have such drastic real world consequences. And the laws and the principles of contract drafting can anticipate that and manage the legal relations between the parties when that occurs. So it's important to keep that in mind.
Do you think all the 1,200 jurors who missed out on their day's wages are going to sue the software manufacturer?
Ah, well, that's a good question, because, you know, they wouldn't be held, they wouldn't be bound by that limitation of liability clause in the software agreement between mm-hmm. the provider of the software and the government. There's no privity of contract there. So, who's to say? I mean, if they could show there was negligence, you know, if the software wasn't made with, you know, reasonable care, it seems like there could be some kind of tort liability there. And clearly, if it was something because of the way that it was implemented, that, you know, a county employee or government employee did in implementing it, then the software provider will be looking to the county for indemnification, you know, to pick up the tab for the developer in defending itself against, you know, defending itself in this lawsuit by the 1,200 disgruntled, would-be jurors.
Hopefully in Placer County, they have better things to do than then sue.
Well, and it would be, you know, that you would definitely want to ask for a jury trial in that so that it can just happen again and again and again, you know, with in resolving this dispute.
Yes. Who was chiming in there, Jonathan?
You just beat me to my first joke, Evan, but I would have to say someone asked for a change of venue, probably, just to be safe. But I can also testify that it does not require a computer error to get 1,200 jurors into one small courtroom. I have been one of those 1,200 jurors before, jurors. It was because I went the first week after classes let out in college, and apparently all the college students were postponing until right after college.
Oh, yeah.
And so I got to go to that. And yet, despite there being only three trials, I still ended up on a murder trial jury. That's my luck.
Oh, that's cool.
Right.
Awesome. It was actually really boring, if you want to know the truth.
Well, those 1,200 jurors might have trouble finding counsel because, you know, it's not exactly the kind of case that a lawyer would be dying to pick up. And I guess that's one of the things that Righthaven is using to justify its existence, is that, gol darn it, we just don't have enough lawyers out there who will serve this vast need of copyright plaintiffs. And so, you know, we're blazing the trail. Evan, our good friend Eric Gardner wrote about this in the ABA Journal in a lengthy piece. Do you want to give us a gloss on that?
Well, first, props to Eric. You know, he's another friend of the show, been on here a number of times. And I first became aware of this piece that he wrote about Righthaven by seeing the hard copy version of the magazine. I was walking down the hallway here at my law firm and, you know, saw it in the inboxes of my colleagues. I was like, whoa, I know that guy. This is awesome. You know, on the front cover of the ABA Journal, it's a very widely read magazine. So props to Eric Gardner on this. So about this issue of Righthaven, the guy saying that there aren't enough competent plaintiffs side copyright lawyers in this country, probably not true. There's a lot of really sharp, smart copyright lawyers out there. This is a question of economics. And that I have a feeling that that's really what Righthaven is addressing here, rather than the skill and the ability of copyright lawyers. It's the incentive on the plaintiff's side to take a case. In a situation where it is a plaintiff, like, let's say it's the Denver Post or the Las Vegas. I can never remember the name of the particular newspaper in Las Vegas that was, you know, one of the big players. The Review Journal, you know, trying to assign their rights to Righthaven so that Righthaven could pursue this litigation against a mom and pop operation, you know, an individual blogger, just a small time operation who is copied wholesale. Even if there are attorney's fees and statutory damages available to the plaintiff in that type of situation, it's not going to make a whole lot of sense much of the time for a plaintiff's lawyer, even one willing to take that matter on a contingency, to sign that client up. Because even if you get a judgment against, you know, the blogger who's living in his parents' basement, you get a judgment. Let's just say you get a nice $10,000 in statutory damages, which is, you know, pretty unlikely that you'd even get that in a situation like this. And, you know, you recover your costs and attorney's fees, another $20,000 there. You know, you get a $30,000 judgment against this guy. It's not going to be it's only going to be worth the paper it's printed on. And, you know, that's not going to be much of an inducement to a plaintiff's copyright. A plaintiff side copyright lawyer in a situation like this, even one who is assuming that willing to work on a contingency, and most lawyers are not, especially copyright lawyers. So I think there's a real problem, a real issue that needs to be addressed if we're going to assume that we would be better served by having more copyright litigation. And I'm not even close to saying that that's a valid premise, but if we are going to make that our premise for the purposes of the analysis, then the resolution of that conundrum is not in raising the skill level of the bar of those, you know, that set of lawyers who are able to take these cases, but it's more in looking and adjusting the economics and the inducement for plaintiffs' lawyers to want to take these kinds of cases. By the way, I just made an argument, or I just, you know, said some stuff that would support an argument that really is pretty anathema to how I actually believe in reality, but that was just, you know, for the sake of talking about it.
Right. Any final words on Righthaven as they go quietly into their good night, Jonathan?
Real fast. I don't know if anyone actually bought any of the copyrights that were for auction, but I know they had some adult films. You could have bought the copyright in them. You could have been in the pornography business. Anyone could have, for about $50. And a whole bunch of articles were on the blog, too. But one thing I wanted to talk about, Evan said about the economics of it. If we're going to assume that we're be behooved by more copyright litigation, then I think the U.S. Copyright Office is set to take up this issue sometime in the coming years, knowing their pacing. But supposedly there's talk about a possibility of a copyright small claims court system that's designed to make it cheaper and more affordable to sue and both to both sue and defend copyright infringement cases, and as an attempt to sort of re-enfranchise a lot of copyright holders that, for as Evan said, for economic reasons, are completely unable to sue right now.
Wow, that's a really good idea. I hadn't heard that that was on the table. That strikes me as an idea whose time has come. What do you think, Venkat?
I somewhat agree with Jonathan's idea that the proposal is worth considering. I thought the article was excellent, and I thought that Right Haven, it's just a combination of hubris and just sloppy litigation. And I was just reading the article going, what were these guys thinking? You know, the guy who runs Right Haven is a lawyer himself, or at least who's involved as an exec in Right Haven and was a lawyer, if correct me if I'm wrong. And he's complaining about finding other competent copyright lawyers. I mean, it's completely ludicrous. It made them look so bad to me. And I think there were a few other details. One of the Randazza quotes, Mark Randazza, who's the lawyer who litigated on the defense side against Right Haven, really demonstrated that it was about greed for Right Haven. I mean, there were a lot of people willing to settle for $1,500, $2,500, and Right Haven really pushed the envelope and did it in a way that where they didn't have a sound legal position, and that just brought down the house of cards. And when you talk about the economics of litigation, I think on the plaintiff side, the economics favor the plaintiffs tremendously. I mean, you look at the Perfect 10 lawsuit we were talking about. It costs $350 to file a complaint, and it's. I think there are a ton of lawyers who would take copyright cases on contingency if there is some assurance of payment on the other side. And with respect to these mom-and-pop operators, really, I think what's appropriate at best is to send a demand letter, and if somebody comes back and says, we'll take it down, we'll pay you $250, Right Haven should have just said, yeah, that makes sense, let's go away. Instead, they're like, no, we want $2,500 or $3,500 or whatever the numbers were, and I'm completely unpersuaded by their CEO's position that it was a combination of the difficulty of finding counsel and that somehow the economics of copyright litigation on the plaintiff side need to be fixed. I mean, if anything, it would run the other way. And I think that Right Haven defendants and people in that position should have stronger incentives and the possibility of covering their attorney's fees. So I'm, you know, after I read this article, I'm just thinking, you know, you're complaining about lawyers. You should just hire a PR person and have them talk to Eric Gardner, because after I read it, I was just sitting there going, this is just ridiculous, you know? No sympathy whatsoever for Right Haven. They just flailed.
None here, no.
No.
And one quick item of clarification, just in case anyone actually is dumb enough to make this mistake. The head of Right Haven's name is Stephen Gibson. That's absolutely no relation to Steve Gibson, who co-hosts the Security Now podcast right here on the
No relation whatsoever. All right. Well, our tip of the week for you this week comes straight to you from the U.S. government. And before you get all skeptical or are inclined to do so, it's actually a really good tip. It's something we've talked about on the show before. And that is, in today's day and age, when you're doing your estate planning, you need to be thinking about the social media aspects of your lives. And the government over at USA.gov on its blog there has a post about how and why you should write a social media will and some specific bullet points to consider when you do so, including the privacy policies and terms and conditions of the sites where you have a presence. So that would be relevant if you intend for those presences to live on or be memorialized after you're gone. State how you would like to have your profiles handled so that whoever's looking after these things for you when you're gone knows what your wishes are. Give your social media executor a document that lists everything, you know, a nice inventory of where you have a profile, a blog, usernames, passwords, everything they would need. You know, consider the things too, I would think, this is not in the government's post, that you might not want to survive you. I'm sure that there are some things out there that people would like to die with them, including the usernames, passwords, all in. And
the content you upload into Tumblr.
Yes, exactly.
No, the content's viewed in Tumblr, not uploaded.
Well, so, whatever floats your boat.
Evan, you tagged this one for us. Did you have any more thoughts?
Well, you know, it's an intriguing concept. The post from the government says that, you know, it's going to give us reasons why we would want to do this social media estate planning. And if you actually read the post, it doesn't really talk about why you would want to do that. So it has a lot of information about how and things that you should keep in mind. So it inspired me to write a post. So I'll just shamelessly ask our viewers and listeners to go over to internetcases.com and read the post that I wrote today. What is today? May 11th. That addresses, you know, why it would be a good idea to do these things, because a lot of the discussion that is had about this presumes that this is something you would want to do. So I gave a little bit of thought and came up with some reasons as to why it actually makes sense for a person to think about these types of issues before they're dead.
Right. And it's certainly not just your social media presences, but, you know, when I was thinking about this and getting ready for the show, there are a bunch of, so much of our lives are lived online and electronically these days. For example, your domain management, you know, I manage the domains for our family and, you know, things that they may need after I'm gone, and they would have no idea, you know, how to go in and have access to those and be able to renew them, et cetera, unless I wrote all that down somewhere. So it's a good thing to sort of take stock of. Of course, you know, people's banking is done in a large online way this way today too. So of course, all your financial and other just data management tasks. So much of it lives on the net one way or another, and is probably, you know, you may be the only person who knows how to access those things. So give that some thought. Let's see. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Can I really fast state my will, my intentions and my will?
Yeah, we are here to witness and attest.
I would like for all of my social media accounts to be shut down and closed upon my death immediately, except for my Twitter account, which will be set up with a bot to send out defamatory statements about Evan Brown every hour on the hour with a hashtag tweets are not libel. Thank you.
There we go.
Well, and I think interesting idea, Jonathan, at least the first half. And I'm curious about whether...
Well, thank you about that.
People would opt in or try to incorporate any sort of kill switch to their social media accounts. And what drives me to say this is that often a person's social media activity might be separate from, you know, their family. And it's not that they may have secrets that they don't want their family to find out about. It's more just that a lot of people, it's a deeply personal thing. And I don't know, I'd be curious to know whether people would feel that, you know, their family members shouldn't continue to run their Twitter account or their blog or something like that. I mean, I like the idea of a memorial page, and I've seen that in a couple of instances, at least in the media, in the press and reported accounts. But I wonder over time if people would say, you know, I'm going to choose the kill switch option.
Yeah, I was about to say,
Jonathan suggested.
It'd be really funny if you could develop like in the movies, a dead man switch, like the bad guy always has. If my heart stops beating, the building blows
yes.
up. If my heart stops beating, right. my social networks all, my social media, my social networking profiles all die. That would
right.
be awesome.
If you've read Damon, you know the degree of complexity that could be involved in such a process. You know, I'm wondering as we talk through this, whether sites will at some point embrace the notion that sort of the medical world and the educational world routinely do, where you have a secondary contact person should anything happen to you. You know, the person you designate right there in your account settings as, who should be contacted, you know, in the event your account has no activity for a lengthy amount of time. And as I think through that, you know, it seems like, yeah, that's a reasonable thing and someone will probably implement that. And then they will be in a world of trouble where the person has actually just, you know, gone on vacation or otherwise been inactive. And then all of a sudden, you know, this other person who, yes, they've designated, but, you know, maybe they don't want to see every little detail of their lives, now has full blown access to whatever it is they've been up to.
And it would be particularly sad if there was that kill switch provision in that as well, where, you know, your life's work is destroyed while you're still alive. I mean, it's all right to do one thing like you're suggesting, Jonathan, to have your work destroyed after your death. I mean, that's what Kafka wanted. But, you know, and so I think there were two people that had the collected works of Kafka, and one person abided by his wishes and another person didn't. So just think of what the world would be like. Well, maybe it wouldn't be that different if we didn't have the works of Kafka, but it depends on who you ask, you know, if they hadn't abided by that. So it can be a dangerous mechanism. A person with a lot of trust you need.
Well, since our shows are frequently Kafka-esque, I think, you know, we would certainly be out of luck if we didn't have that tag to put on it. And along those lines, here's definitely an app that qualifies for being Kafka-esque. And a direct answer to the is anyone up problem. This was written about by Cash Hill, who's going to join us next week on 12 over at her Forbes blog. It's about an app called Snapchat, which the developer euphemistically calls real-time picture chatting. And what it is the ability to text someone a photo. There is no stipulation of what may or may not be included in the photo. And the photo will, you can set the time frame for how long it will actually persist on the recipient side. It can be there from 1 to 10 seconds, at which point it goes poof. And they no longer have that to dangle over you anymore.
dangle, interesting choice of words, Denise. Very interesting.
Very bad choice of words. Guys, what do you think of Snapchat?
I plead the fifth. Yeah, my wife might be watching this. So, yeah. Hi, honey.
You know, certain politicians certainly would have liked to have known of its existence, or I'm sure they prompted its creation, perhaps. Evan?
Yeah, have you downloaded it? What's your username?
Yeah, no, sorry. Not yet. Chat me up after. Ben Cat?
I think it's a great idea. Not from the point of view necessarily of sending off-color pictures, but you know, I could see it being useful in other scenarios as well. I often think emails living on is such a big problem that I wonder, you know, some sort of email self-destruct. And I've heard about similar apps, but they never seem to be widely adopted. Or I guess text messages self-destructing would certainly be useful in a lot of scenarios. So I'm curious about it.
As a parent, I like the idea. You know, I like the thought that as my child grows older, I'll be able to give him something that enables him to do naughty things with his phone, but that will enable him to have silly, you know, off-color chat with friends and not have it be there as a smoking gun that can arise down the road or otherwise be, you know, as troublesome as that stuff can be.
What's to stop somebody from just taking a screenshot or a photo of what's sent? I'm always curious about that.
Never thought of that.
That's what Colin was saying in the studio, too. Nothing at all. So it's a slight solution, but not a total solution. All right. Well, with that, this has been a really fun and silly show in many ways. I really appreciate you guys joining me today. Venkat, always great to chat with you.
Thank you.
Any thoughts you want to leave our viewers with before we go, or anything else that's on your mind just to wrap up?
We didn't get a chance to talk about Facebook passwords, but that's just as... I guess we did. So I don't have any closing thoughts. It's been great to be on the show, and it's a nice day in Seattle, so I think I might try to take an opportunity to get outside and enjoy the weather as we do here on the few days that it's nice.
That's right. Don't you just sort of abandon all clothing and frolic free whenever the sun comes out there in Seattle?
I mean, it gets above 60 degrees and people literally freak out. So it's that kind of day.
Good, good. Well, glad you get to go and join it. Thanks so much. Enjoy it. Enjoying it. My goodness, we must be on a law show. Really great to chat with you. And folks should definitely, if they're not already religiously reading Eric Goldman's technology and marketing blog, do so, because Venkat is a really great contributor there. He's also on Twitter and Google+, so find him in those spots too.
Thank you.
Evan, always great to chat with you as well.
Yes, the same to you. I've really enjoyed the show, and it's great to have our friends Jonathan and Venkat. Really a fun conversation. I think we were discussing before the show started, I think we've actually had this same panel of four people before, right? So this is kind of an encore.
Feels very familiar. Yes.
Yeah, just all kinds of great stuff. When
you think we'd be better at it by now, but no.
Still making it up as we go along. That's just the way to do it. So, but yeah, really have enjoyed talking with you all, and I hope you have a good weekend. And great to connect, and look forward to doing it again soon.
I may have to change Twill's tagline to that. I usually say the web's law department at your service, and now I think still making it up as we go along is probably the better choice for that.
More
Jonathan,
accurate.
Thank you for helping us make it up this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Denise. It's been a true pleasure. Thank you, Evan, and thank you, Venkat, for providing levity and seriousness to this conversation and not making any jokes or having any humor about anything. Really,
all business.
We like to play it straight here on Twill, if you haven't noticed. It's a very serious show. But no, thank you for having me. It's been a great time. Really,
it's great because you are very much all business over at Plagiarism today. Oh, and I absolutely love having you on the show because you're so not that when you come here and join us.
No, I'm not business anywhere but Plagiarism today. That's like where I get my business out of my system. So
that's
I can
good.
Be
I'm...
someone else everywhere else.
It's good you have an outlet. And of course, Jonathan's also on Google+, and he's Plagiarism today over on Twitter. Any final words or thoughts, Jonathan, for our viewers?
To love each other and take care of your fellow man. Thank
you. That's good. And happy Mother's Day as well. As
oh,
we
happy
go
Mother's
into
Day, yes. Call Mom.
That weekend. Yes, go Mom. So folks, between the shows, please do come on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw or our Google+ page. We do a lot of stuff between the shows. Actually, I do it mostly on my personal Google+ account because it's just easier than switching over to the page. I don't know if that's like a design bug we're noticing there with Google+, but I do on my personal account there post up stories that we're thinking about, talking about. I try and air out topics and get people's thoughts in advance so that we can share your thoughts with everyone else when we talk about the subjects in question. So head on over there. And our show page is at twit.tv/twill. You can find all our archives of shows in that handy location. Or you can find us on iTunes and on YouTube, wherever else you like to find and consume your video cast or podcast entertainment. And you can email me between the shows. I'm Denise@twit.tv. I love hearing from you. You guys always have such great ideas for us. Keep them coming. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.